Welcome to Immigration Review, your weekly source for immigration case law updates and insights. I'm your host, Kevin A. Gregg, back again to review the week's precedential immigration cases, rummaging through the decisions so you don't have to. This podcast is sponsored by Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, also known as KKTP, a law firm where I'm also a partner. Whether you are facing an immigration obstacle, a serious injury, or a legal issue in your business, KKTP will aggressively protect your best interests. And as always, this show does not constitute legal advice and has no bias other than to keep you up to date and to enable you, my dear colleagues, to excel in court. So, without further ado, let's start the review. It's episode 9 of Immigration Review. I cannot express enough how grateful I am for each and every one of you tuning in. Earlier in the week, I was loving the multiple 10 to 14 page decisions out of the circuits, even though some of the cases and drug names were really testing my pronunciation skills. But then came Justice Alito's unfortunate decision, followed by 5 circuit decisions, all issued on Friday, totaling 9 decisions. Never fear, listeners, the Immigration Review is here. We'll be speaking about due process, or lack thereof, admin closure, Jeff Sessions' oldest adversary, drugs, persecution, torture, lots of hardship and lots of hard cases this week. There are wins, losses, and a lot in between. Now, on to the first case. We're going to start with the Supreme Court case this week. I hope everyone had a chance to listen to our special episode with Ira Kurzban discussing the Supreme Court's DACA decision. If you didn't, please check out our special episode. It's a treatise on DACA, the Supreme Court, and administrative law. The Supreme Court concluded their immigration cases this term by publishing DHS et al. V. Thurasigam on June 25th. It's a 7-2 decision written by Justice Alito, with concurrences and dissents totaling 98 pages. Nothing brief about this one. This case is about whether appellate courts have jurisdiction to review no credible fear findings, and the majority says no. Due to time constraints and because cases like this don't directly affect arguments made in immigration court, I'm not going to get in depth into the court's heady constitutional rationale, but I will provide the holding, and I'll take some jabs at Justice Alito along the way. Brief background. Instead of initiating removal proceedings, with all its attendant due process protections, the immigration statutes provide ICE with authority to expeditiously remove certain non-citizens. The Trump administration has broken with all prior administrations and instructed ICE to exercise its expedited removal authority to the maximum extent possible against as many non-citizens as possible. Pretty much the only way to avoid removal, if subjected to expedited removal, is for a non-citizen to claim a fear of persecution or torture in their home country. But if subjected to expedited removal, the non-citizen doesn't get to bring his or her claim before an immigration judge unless an ICE or USCIS officer, often not an attorney, believes that the non-citizen has a credible fear. A fairly amorphous phrase. Congress made this initial credible fear determination unreviewable by federal courts, meaning that there exists little oversight over ICE's decisions to remove asylum seekers. The no credible fear finding can, however, be reviewed by an immigration judge in an expedited fashion. The Ninth Circuit held that this process was unconstitutional under the Suspension Clause and Due Process Clause to the Constitution. In this case, the Supreme Court said, au contraire, the Constitution does not apply. Here are Justice Alito's 2 quotes, summarizing the holdings. First, quote, respondents' suspension clause argument fails because it would extend the writ of habeas corpus far beyond its scope when the Constitution was drafted and ratified, end quote. And second, quote, Congress is entitled to set the conditions for an alien's lawful entry into this country, and as a result, an alien at the threshold of initial entry cannot claim any greater rights under the Due Process Clause, end quote. In other words, the non-citizen in this case has no constitutional rights, even though he was an asylum seeker from Sri Lanka and he was 25 yards inside the United States when he was apprehended. The majority said he had no rights because he entered illegally, and ICE chose to place him in expedited removal proceedings. Even though he was inside the United States, he is only entitled to those rights granted to him by Congress through statute and not in the U.S. Constitution. I can only imagine that this decision will embolden the Trump administration and its current immigration policies. So that's basically the holding. Here are some jabs to Justice Alito, because, well, I can. First off, Justice Alito, unlike Justice Kavanaugh in his two immigration decisions this term, seems quite fine using the word alien instead of non-citizen. Second, Justice Alito's decision certainly contains a lot of policy arguments for someone who asserts himself as a textualist and who often bemoans the court's entry into matters he deems should be left to Congress, including in his DACA dissent just last week. Just saying. Third, and I must say, I'm not sure what Justice Alito's law clerk was thinking writing this or in allowing Justice Alito to write this. But Justice Alito states the following sentence at page 14 of his decision to deny constitutional rights to an asylum seeker from Sri Lanka. Quote, "While respondent does not claim an entitlement to release, the U.S. government is happy to release him, provided the release occurs in the cabin of a plane bound for Sri Lanka. That would be the equivalent of the habeas relief." End quote. I'll let Justice Alito speak for himself with that one. And finally, to end on somewhat of an upbeat note, footnote 21 recognizes that this decision does not necessarily preclude similar challenges in the future, if based on new facts and new, creative constitutional arguments. Thanks for throwing us a bone, Justice. And that is DHS et al. V. Thurasigam. Next up is a big one out of the Seventh Circuit, Meza Morales v. Barr, published on June 26, 2020. This is a bit of a complicated one, involving multiple aspects of immigration law. It discusses U visas and immigration court waivers, but most importantly, it holds that the IJs have authority to administratively close removal proceedings and that Attorney General Sessions was wrong in matter of Castro-Tum. So starting off with a bit of background on U visas. A non-citizen who is a victim of certain crimes while in the United States and who assists police may petition for U non-immigrant status, also referred to as a U visa. It's a complicated process, and DHS, through its sub-agency USCIS, has the sole authority to grant or deny a U visa. To obtain a U visa, applicants must also be admissible to the United States, that is, not barred under Section 212 of the INA. In the Seventh Circuit, like in the 11th Circuit, inadmissible U visa applicants can either apply to have USCIS waive their inadmissibility, or, if they're in removal proceedings, they can ask the immigration judge to waive their inadmissibility, even though only USCIS can ultimately grant the actual U visa. Finally, because USCIS is only allowed to grant 10,000 U visas per year, there's a wait list. But ICE doesn't remove people with tentative U visa grants who are on the wait list. Now to Mr. Meza Morales' case. He was brought to the United States unlawfully as a child. As a young adult, he was shot in the ankle by a group of men and cooperated with police against them. He then applied for a U visa, but before USCIS had a chance to decide it, DHS initiated removal proceedings against Mr. Meza Morales in immigration court for his unlawful presence in the U.S. and because he was once caught possessing some marijuana. The IJ granted Mr. Meza Morales a waiver of inadmissibility under INA Section 212D3A, making him admissible for U visa purposes, and continued proceedings for 30 days to allow USCIS to decide the U visa. But unsurprisingly, USCIS didn't decide his application in 30 days. And at the next hearing, the IJ denied Mr. Morales' request for a continuance and his request to administratively close his case to await a U visa decision. Then, notwithstanding his previous grant of a waiver of inadmissibility, the IJ ordered Mr. Meza Morales removed, and the BIA affirmed. Mr. Meza Morales petitioned to the Seventh Circuit, and during the pending petition, USCIS granted the U visa, and placed Mr. Meza Morales on the wait list. Before the Seventh Circuit, Mr. Meza Morales made three interesting, potentially law-changing arguments, and succeeded on one. And to sample John Lennon, all you need is one. First, Mr. Meza Morales argued that because the IJ waived his inadmissibility under INA Section 212d3a, the IJ shouldn't have ordered him removed on the basis of this same inadmissibility. The Seventh Circuit gave it some thought but said no. It reasoned that Section 212d3a waivers are filed in conjunction with applications for lawful admission into the United States. It's one thing to grant the waiver in conjunction with a U visa application or another visa application, because if granted, the applicant receives lawful status. But Mr. Meza Morales, by contrast, is requesting that the 212d3a waiver prevent his removability, even if, for example, the U visa is denied. He's essentially asking for a standalone 212d3a waiver, and the Seventh Circuit said that's a bridge too far. Okay, fine. Second, Mr. Morales argued that the IJ improperly denied a continuance, and OIL agreed before the Seventh Circuit due to recent Seventh Circuit and BIA precedent making prima facie eligibility for a U visa the most important continuance factor. So the Seventh Circuit remanded for further consideration of a continuance. Okay, kind of a partial win for Mr. Meza Morales. But third, the Seventh Circuit held that matter of Castro Tum was wrongly decided by Attorney General Sessions, and that IJs have authority to administratively close cases. Take that, Beauregard. Real quick, administrative closure is a temporary closure of removal proceedings. IJs used to admin close proceedings all the time, where appropriate, until Jeff Beauregard Sessions said they couldn't anymore in matter of Castro Tum. As the Seventh Circuit explained, under the Supreme Court's recent Wilkie decision, the court may only defer to matter of Castro Tum if the regulations Attorney General Sessions was interpreting are truly and definitively ambiguous as to whether IJs lack authority to administratively close a case. And they're not. Specifically, and to paraphrase a bit, 8 CFR Section 1003.10b grants an IJ the power to take any action consistent with the law appropriate and necessary for disposition of cases. This includes administrative closure, and aligns with the Fourth Circuit case last year. Hopefully Castro Tum's days are numbered. So, Mr. Meza Morales gets the time he needs to obtain lawful status through his U visa process. Congrats, Mr. Meza Morales, and congrats to your very smart lawyers. Long case, but a good case. I'll be quick with my observations. First, the Seventh Circuit throws some serious shade on the current administration's obsession with expeditious adjudication of cases, so this is a good case for use in continuance briefs. And lastly, I must simply note, Mr. Meza Morales was in immigration prison through this entire multi-year process, and the only reason he wasn't physically removed to Mexico after the BIA denied his appeal is because the Seventh Circuit made the extraordinary decision to stay his removal pending petition for review. The hardship, complexity, and expense to all this is astronomical. And even where non-citizens can afford it and wait it out, circuit courts rarely grant stays. I can't help but believe that for every Mr. Meza Morales, there are hundreds more like him who end up deported instead. And that is Meza Morales v. Barr. Next up, the Eighth Circuit is back again, with Ortiz v. Barr, published on June 23, 2020. This case is about crimes involving moral turpitude and obstruction of justice crimes. Mr. Ortiz is a lawful permanent resident, or LPR, who pled guilty to having violated Minnesota Statute Section 609.50, Subdivision 2-2, obstruction of legal process, arrest, or firefighting. An IJ, and then the BIA, found him removable for his conviction, holding that it matched the definition of a crime of violence aggravated felony, as defined at 18 U.S.C. Section 16A. And remember, convictions that match the definition of an aggravated felony make LPRs removable. Based on the same obstruction crime, DHS also charged Mr. Ortiz as removable as an LPR who had been convicted of a crime involving moral turpitude, or CIMT, within 5 years of getting his LPR status. And also remember, under immigration law, a single CIMT doesn't make an LPR removable unless it's committed within 5 years of receiving LPR status. In this case, because the IJ found Mr. Ortiz removable for the aggravated felony, the IJ and the BIA did not address the CIMT issue. But on petition for review in 2015, in the published decision Ortiz v. Lynch, the Eighth Circuit found that Mr. Ortiz's conviction was not an aggravated felony and sent the case back for a CIMT analysis. On remand, the IJ and then the BIA held that the conviction was a CIMT, namely because it requires an evil intent and, quote, involves some aggravating level of force or violence in the context of interference with important and legitimate government functions, end quote. Back on appeal, the Eighth Circuit disagreed again. First, the Eighth Circuit noted, relying on an unpublished BIA decision and the published 1980 BIA decision matter of Logan, that when determining whether an obstruction conviction constitutes a CIMT, the BIA must apply the same analysis it uses to determine whether assault crimes are CIMTs. Importantly, assault crimes don't usually qualify as CIMTs because they are only general intent crimes and don't require culpable mental states, like a specific intent to commit the crime. Such general intent crimes don't usually qualify as CIMTs unless conviction also requires an aggravating factor, such as use of a deadly weapon or intentional bodily harm, that sort of thing. With that standard for a CIMT in mind, the Eighth Circuit applied, as it must, the categorical approach, and presumed, as it must under the Supreme Court cases Mullooly and Moncrief, that Mr. Ortiz's obstruction conviction rested on the least culpable conduct criminalized by the statute. The court noted, based on Minnesota case law and the plain language of the statute, that Minnesota's obstruction crime is a general intent crime, like assault, and requires no specific mens rea or mental state. As such, conviction only qualifies as a CIMT if it requires a high degree of harm or another aggravating factor. And the Eighth Circuit held, again based on Minnesota case law, that this conviction does not. Indeed, in one case, a Minnesota appeals court upheld an obstruction conviction where the defendant simply assumed the fetal position to prevent officers from handcuffing him, hardly inherently base, vile, or depraved. And that's it. After many, many years of fighting, Mr. Ortiz gets to keep his green card because his conviction does not match the definition of an aggravated felony or a CIMT. Great holding for non-citizens. Here's some even better stuff. First, although the Eighth Circuit noted that the record was unclear as to the specific criminal subsection Mr. Ortiz was convicted for having violated, it also noted, in a footnote, that the specific subsections of Minnesota's obstruction statute are means and not alternative elements that a jury must agree upon to convict. Therefore, this decision would not likely change even if the subsection of conviction was known, because Minnesota's obstruction crime is not divisible. And because the statute is not divisible, courts must presume that what occurred in a given case is the least culpable conduct criminalized by the statute, which, as made clear in this case, still falls below the CIMT definition. Again, think fetal position conviction. And lastly, the court issued a pretty blanket statement that, quote, obstruction of legal process is not inherently base, vile, or depraved, end quote. This quote would appear to preclude a CIMT finding for all simple obstruction of justice convictions. So thank you for that, Eighth Circuit. And that is Ortiz v. Barr. Next up is Gordon v. U.S. Attorney General, published by the 11th Circuit on June 24th. This is a decision out of my home circuit, with both Judge Pryors, Bill and Jill, actually in agreement, and with recent 11th Circuit appointment Judge Luck rounding out the panel. It's a controlled substance aggravated felony case, and it rules against the non-citizen. Here we go. Mr. Gordon is an LPR from Jamaica who was convicted of some drug and firearm crimes. DHS threw a smorgasbord of removability allegations against him. But narrowing it down, if, as the IJ found, one of Mr. Gordon's crimes qualifies as an aggravated felony, Mr. Gordon is both removable and barred from cancellation of removal for LPRs under INA Section 240AA, which would otherwise potentially prevent his removal. So this decision comes down to one thing. Does Mr. Gordon's conviction under Georgia Statute Section 16-13-30B and D for possession of ecstasy with the intent to distribute qualify as an aggravated felony? The 11th Circuit said yes, and here's why. One of the various aggravated felonies under immigration law is defined at INA Section 101A43B, illicit trafficking in a controlled substance. To meet this definition, state offenses, here Georgia possession with intent, must require a trafficking element, and must necessarily criminalize trafficking of a controlled substance, as defined in the Federal Controlled Substance List. Now sometimes, these cases come down to whether the state conviction requires a trafficking element, and I personally find those cases pretty interesting. This is not one of those cases. This decision is all about whether, under the categorical approach, the court can determine if Mr. Gordon possessed ecstasy. The IJ, BIA, and 11th Circuit all agree that the Georgia Controlled Substance List covers more drugs than the federal list, making it overbroad and not categorically a removable offense. So unless the Georgia Possession with Intent statute is divisible as to the drug at issue, the conviction is not an aggravated felony. Unfortunately for Mr. Gordon, the 11th Circuit held that the statute is divisible because, looking to Georgia Supreme Court case law, specifically Tab v. State, possession of each controlled substance listed in Georgia's list is, quote, a separate offense, end quote. Therefore, reviewing the conviction documents under the modified categorical approach, the 11th Circuit confirmed that yes indeed, Mr. Gordon possessed ecstasy with intent to distribute. Now, Mr. Gordon also argued that even though his conviction documents list the word ecstasy, ecstasy isn't actually a drug listed in either the federal or Georgia lists. Rather, the various lists contain the chemical compounds of ecstasy, not the word ecstasy. Meaning, according to Mr. Gordon, that a conviction for simply ecstasy doesn't match the federal controlled substance list. Very clever, Mr. Gordon. The 11th Circuit rejected this argument because methylenedioxymethamphetamine, or MDMA, is listed in the federal and Georgia lists, and Georgia routinely refers to MDMA as ecstasy in its prosecutions. So for those reasons, Mr. Gordon is both removable for having been convicted of an aggravated felony and is ineligible for cancellation of removal. Now to some good stuff. First, as Judge Jill Pryor writes, the 11th Circuit only looks to state case law, as it did in this case and in Gillen v. U.S. Attorney General, if, quote, the statute on its face fails to provide a clear answer on divisibility, end quote. As I keep noting on this podcast, this quote, putting a premium on the statutory text, further shows that the BIA was wrong when it opined last year in matter of Navarro-Guadarrama that the 11th Circuit no longer follows its Ramos decision from 2013, and that non-citizens must still satisfy the realistic probability test even where the statutory text resolves the issue. Mark my words, 11th Circuit practitioners, Ramos remains good law, with, of course, the previously stated qualification that this is not legal advice. Second, and a good thing for crimmigration attorneys to remember, as Judge Pryor notes in footnote 4, the categorical analysis requires courts to apply the state and federal controlled substance lists in effect at the time of a non-citizen's conviction, not at the time of his removal proceedings. And finally, under the realistic probability test, if Mr. Gordon could have found a case where Georgia charged a defendant with possession of ecstasy and the underlying drug was not MDMA and not listed in the federal controlled substance lists, Mr. Gordon could have defeated the aggravated felony charge. Such a case or conviction might be out there somewhere. Immigration practitioners and criminal practitioners should work together in concert to develop a database of criminal charges and non-published cases for use as necessary. Just this week, actually, an immigration attorney working in a public defender's office in Texas named Jordan Pollock informed me that she loves the podcast, so thank you, Jordan. But more importantly, that her office possesses conviction documents that could have satisfied the realistic probability test in the Fifth Circuit case Alexis v. Barr, the cocaine isomer case discussed 2 weeks ago on the podcast. So let's get the ball rolling on this. If you're a criminal law attorney and you're listening, please send me redacted conviction documents that show that states prosecute criminal conduct in a manner that does not meet the federal definition of a removable offense. Convictions or pleas for possessing drugs not listed in the federal list is a good place to start. Please consult with your immigration friends and send me cases. The movement begins now. And that is Gordon v. U.S. Attorney General. Moving on, we have Valadez Lara v. Barr, published by the Sixth Circuit on June 26, 2020. This case is about in absentia motions to reopen based on a lack of notice of a removal hearing. Mr. Valadez Lara is my age, but he was born in Mexico. When we were both in high school, Mr. Valadez Lara's mother died, and he came to the United States without authorization to be with his father, a migrant farm worker. He ended up living with his aunt and uncle in Ohio, but after getting caught being drunk at the age of 15, he was served with a notice to appear in immigration court removal proceedings by DHS. 15-year-old Mr. Valadez Lara signed the NTA himself, which did not have the date and time of his hearing in it, because DHS didn't start putting the date and time of hearings in NTA until the Supreme Court's Pereira decision 2 years ago. The immigration court sent Mr. Valadez Lara 4 notices of hearing for 4 different dates. His aunt and uncle claim that they never received any of them, because the post office often mistakes their address. Mr. Valadez Lara didn't appear for his hearing, and as required under the INA and regulations, the IJ ordered him removed in absentia. 2 years later, he was caught speeding and removed to Mexico for the outstanding removal order. He re-entered the U.S. illegally at least 5 times, and he was eventually charged in federal court for illegal re-entry, a federal crime. He filed a motion to reopen his initial in absentia removal order for lack of notice, which I believe, if granted, would have then required dismissal of the criminal illegal re-entry charges. The Sixth Circuit engages in a pretty academic overview of in absentia motion to reopen requirements, but ultimately holds that when balanced, Mr. Valadez Lara had failed to meet his burden to establish that the notices didn't reach his aunt and uncle's home. For example, despite his aunt and uncle submitting affidavits attesting to non-receipt, the notices weren't returned to the post office as non-deliverable, and Mr. Valadez Lara waited many years to file his motion to reopen. So, the Sixth Circuit affirmed denial of Mr. Valadez Lara's motion to reopen. One interesting observation. As many practitioners know, the statute requires personal service of hearing notices unless personal service is not, quote, practicable, in which case regular mail suffices. In this case, the Sixth Circuit noted that Mr. Valadez Lara had not argued that personal service was not practicable and that mail service was not improper. I've never seen such an argument made, though I haven't been around that long, but I'd very much like to make it. I imagine that non-citizens don't often make the practicable argument because it would require the non-citizen to concede that he or she did in fact live at the address where the notices of hearing were being mailed to. But I'm going to keep this argument in mind. And that is Valadez Lara v. Barr. Next up is a case out of the Second Circuit, Tanu Santoso et al. V. Barr, published on June 23, 2020. This is a case about changed country conditions motions to reopen. The non-citizen petitioners in this case are Christians from Indonesia. Their asylum applications, filed on the basis of their religion, were denied by an IJ and then the BIA in 2004. Let's start with some background. Non-citizens who have had their asylum application denied and have been ordered removed but have not yet been physically removed from the United States can file a motion to reopen their removal proceedings at any time to again apply for asylum if country conditions have changed in their country since the IJ or BIA denied their asylum application. In 2017, the petitioners did just that and filed a motion to reopen based on changed country conditions in Indonesia. They submitted evidence, including news articles and U.S. government reports, documenting recent and specific instances of persecution of Christians in Indonesia, sometimes with government connections. The BIA summarily denied the motion, finding that the Indonesian government was working to promote religious freedom. The BIA also believed it important that petitioners had not filed a new asylum application with their motion to reopen, as the BIA believed was required by 8 CFR 1003.2C1. Spoiler alert, it's not required. The Second Circuit reversed and remanded. It found that the BIA had failed to actually consider the evidence the petitioners submitted, and instead had simply held that the Indonesian government was trying their best. This doesn't cut it. As to the BIA's belief that a changed country condition motion to reopen must include a new asylum application, the court made clear that no such requirement exists. Although other motions to reopen to apply for relief must indeed include a copy of the proposed application, in the case of changed country condition motions to reopen, an asylum application has already been filed and previously denied. So there's no reason, under the regulations or using basic logic, to require the filing of a new application. Therefore, the case was sent back to the BIA for full and fair consideration of the petitioner's motion to reopen. Congratulations to the petitioners. I have just one observation. In reaching its holding, the Second Circuit stated that the BIA, quote, must explicitly consider any country conditions evidence submitted by an applicant that materially bears on his claim, end quote. Although the BIA need not expressly refute every piece of evidence submitted, the BIA must, according to the Second Circuit, quote, address a petitioner's primary evidence, particularly when the evidence is credible and points toward a conclusion contrary to that reached by the BIA, end quote. This is a fairly stringent requirement and potentially opens the door to a wide range of challenges to BIA or IJ fact-finding, so it's a good quote to remember. It also conforms with a similar decision last year out of the Third Circuit, Liam v. Attorney General, a First Circuit decision 2 years ago, Siotang v. Sessions, and an unpublished 11th Circuit decision from this year, Krishnawati v. U.S. Attorney General. So take that, BIA. And that is Tanner Santoso et al. V. Barr. Next, we're going to talk about Cedillos Cedillos v. Barr, published by the Fourth Circuit on June 26, 2020. This is a case about asylum in El Salvador, specifically for those who cooperate with police. Mr. Cedillos Cedillos witnessed his neighbors and a gang member in El Salvador beat his brother to death. Mr. Cedillos and his father reported the murder, but police couldn't help them. Mr. Cedillos was then stalked and threatened by the people who killed his brother, until he himself fled to the United States. His family in El Salvador, however, remains there unharmed. The IJ and BIA found that Mr. Cedillos failed to establish, as required, that he had a well-founded fear of future persecution, and that any harm he feared was on account of a protected ground. Although the IJ and the BIA recognized that a family qualifies as a particular social group for asylum, the agency held that any fear Mr. Cedillos had was because he reported the murder to police and because he was at risk of retaliation. Bit of an aside, some non-attorney listeners might be thinking that this is a distinction without a difference. Why should it matter why these people want to murder Mr. Cedillos? I think all immigration attorneys would agree. Unfortunately, Congress and the courts have decided that it matters why people want to murder non-citizens, and the reason could be the difference why someone gets to stay in the U.S. and someone gets deported. And in this vein, the Fourth Circuit affirmed the asylum denial for Mr. Cedillos. It held that the record showed that the attackers wanted to kill Mr. Cedillos because he was the sole witness to his brother's murder, not because he was his brother's brother. And that made all the difference. because it means that Mr. Cedillos could not establish a nexus between a protected ground under asylum law, like family membership, and the harm he feared. Accordingly, Mr. Cedillos will be deported. But here are two good quotes. First, the Fourth Circuit reaffirmed its 2011 decision Crespin-Valladares that, quote, credible death threats, end quote, even without physical harm, can constitute persecution. And second, the Fourth Circuit recognized that it has, quote, held that a nuclear family provides a prototypical example of a particular social group, end quote. As I keep mentioning on the podcast, such a sentence seems to contradict Attorney General Barr's decision in matter of LEA II. Circuits seem to keep reaffirming their prior family-based asylum cases without addressing LEA II directly. So I'm pretty excited for some circuit to finally address this upcoming conflict soon. And that is Cedillos Cedillos v. Barr. Staying with asylum-type relief, we've got a case out of the Eighth Circuit on June 26, Omar v. Barr. This is a short Convention Against Torture case, denying claims brought by a non-citizen from Somalia. Mr. Omar came to the United States as a child and as a refugee in 1995, and became an LPR, but was later convicted of various drug and theft offenses. Because of his convictions, he was deemed removable and ineligible for everything except deferral of removal under the Convention Against Torture. Interesting quirk of immigration law, and there are so many. U.S. treaty obligations under the Convention Against Torture prohibit the U.S. from removing even the worst criminals if the non-citizen will be tortured if removed. Those non-citizens are still eligible for deferral of removal under the Convention Against Torture, or CAT. Now, Mr. Omar certainly doesn't seem like the worst criminal, but because of the nature of convictions, he was only eligible for CAT deferral. And an IJ granted it, because he's from a minority clan in Somalia, and he suffers from HIV. And such people, the IJ found, are tortured in Somalia, including being stoned to death. But DHS appealed, and the BIA reversed, reaching opposite conclusions based on the evidence. On petition for review, OIL, the DOJ Immigration Appeals Unit, first argued that because of Mr. Omar's crimes, the Eighth Circuit lacked jurisdiction to review his CAT claims. The Eighth Circuit summarily rejected this argument under the recent Supreme Court case Nasrallah v. Barr, discussed on the June 8th episode of the podcast, making this the first application of Nasrallah in a published case. Nice try, OIL. But even jumping over that jurisdictional hurdle, Mr. Omar, like all CAT petitioners, had a high burden to meet to get the BIA's CAT findings reversed. And he couldn't meet it. So the Eighth Circuit denied his petition for review. Some notes. First, because Mr. Omar received CAT protection, he did not cross-appeal the IJ's findings to the BIA that he was ineligible for certain forms of relief or that his crimes qualified as aggravated felonies. Because he didn't cross-appeal to the BIA, the Eighth Circuit held that he had waived the issue once it finally got before the Eighth Circuit on petition for review. So remember to cross-appeal your partial wins, practitioners. And second, the Eighth Circuit read the BIA's 2018 decision, matter of JRGP, as requiring IJs and the BIA to consider all potential harms together in the aggregate when determining whether there exists at least a 51% chance of torture. I haven't read this BIA case in a while, but if true, as the Eighth Circuit and other courts have similarly held, it means that in immigration courts nationwide, practitioners should argue that IJs must consider all harms in the aggregate and not independently, as IJs so often do outside the Ninth Circuit. And that is Omar v. Barr. Next is Sashua Jaimes v. Barr, published by the Ninth Circuit on June 26, 2020. This is another CAT deferral case, this time for an individual from Mexico, and the Ninth Circuit granted the petition. And just a bit of a warning, the facts are pretty disturbing. The petitioner has lived in the United States for over 20 years, since fleeing Mexico for the United States after being raped multiple times as a teenager by her family, and then being ejected from her home for being a lesbian. In the U.S., she entered a pretend relationship with a man named Luna, who was a Mexican member of Los Zetas drug cartel, an extremely dangerous international criminal organization in Mexico. He too ended up abusing and raping the petitioner over many years, resulting in 5 children. On return to Mexico, the petitioner was beaten and threatened at gunpoint by Luna's Los Zetas family members. Back in the U.S., the abuse continued, until eventually, Luna sexually molested one of petitioner's children. When petitioner called the U.S. police, Luna fled, but he returned and did it again. A neighbor called the police, and Luna is now serving 37 years in prison. But then, Arizona Child Protective Services came to the petitioner's home while she was at work and took her children away. My God. Over the next few years, petitioner was threatened at gunpoint by Luna's Los Zetas family members in the U.S. They cut the brakes to her car, slashed her tires, broke the windows to her home, and told her she'd be murdered if she returned to Mexico. It gets worse. The petitioner was then tricked by a co-worker into acting as a drug mule. She pled to a 1.5-year sentence for possession of marijuana for sale. After her sentence, she was placed in removal proceedings, where, because of her conviction, she was deemed eligible only for deferral of removal under the CAT. The IJ and the BIA denied protection. The Ninth Circuit found a lot wrong with the agency's decision, and held that the record compels a grant of CAT deferral. To summarize, the court relied on years' worth of Ninth Circuit case law, plus the evidence in this case, to find that corrupt Mexican police do indeed acquiesce to and participate in the torturous acts of cartels like Los Zetas in Mexico, and that there is no, quote, rogue official exception to CAT protection. Second, the Ninth Circuit held, relying on its 2015 decision Maldonado v. Lynch, that petitioners don't have to show, as the IJ and the BIA seemingly required, that relocation within Mexico is impossible. Rather, because no evidence showed in this case that the petitioner could safely avoid Los Zetas in Mexico, the IJ erred in finding otherwise. That the petitioner could not relocate was buttressed by how LGBTQ individuals are treated throughout Mexico. So, after a very difficult journey, Ms. Sashua Jaimes gets to stay in the United States. Great decision for the non-citizen. Here's some more stuff. First, it appears to me, based on this decision, that every claim brought in the Ninth Circuit based on a fear of Los Zetas in Mexico should satisfy the government actor prong for asylum or CAT protection. It also appears to me, following this decision in Maldonado, that unless DHS or the IJ identify specific evidence tailored to a non-citizen's claims that shows that the non-citizen can relocate within a country of removal, the non-citizen will satisfy her relocation burden under CAT. And finally, as the Ninth Circuit notes, it is inappropriate, as occurred in this case, for an IJ to deny relief or protection based on the fact that an LGBTQ individual can hide his or her sexual identity. And that is Sashua Jaimes v. Barr. So there you have it. You're all caught up with the past week's published immigration cases. I'm Kevin A. Gregg, a partner with the law firm Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, and this has been another episode of Immigration Review. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share it with a friend and rate and review us. Each review helps new listeners find the show. And of course, subscribe to Immigration Review wherever you get your podcasts. For questions, comments, or anything at all, email me at kgregg@kktplaw.com. That's K-G-R-E-G-G @kktplaw.com. And follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Immigration Review. And send us a tweet at @imreview. That's I-M-M review. I'll be back next Monday for a brand new discussion. Until then, I'm Kevin A. Gregg, bringing you the Immigration Review. Thank you.